Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's recent defense of his foreign policy and speak with David Rothkopf, the CEO and editor of Foreign Policy magazine, where he has an article, The Audacity of Small Ball, Obama's Defense of His Foreign Policy Illustrates Much of What's Wrong with It. We'll discuss Obama's defensive explanation of his administration's record on foreign policy, which was provoked by criticism from a pugnacious Fox News reporter, and look at a new poll that indicates close to 50% of Americans favor a less active foreign policy, with only 19% wanting the U.S. to be more assertive and involved. Then, with the grisly botched execution of a death row prisoner in Oklahoma, we'll look into a new study that finds 1 in 20 death row inmates sentenced to death are likely innocent. Sam Gross, the lead author of the study, Rate of False Conviction of Criminal Defendants Who Are Sentenced to Death, published by the National Academy of Sciences, joins us. He is a professor of law at the University of Michigan and the editor of the National Registry of Exonerations, and we will discuss why there are more innocent death row inmates than those exonerated and why avoiding the death sentence often means innocent prisoners still rot in jail for the rest of their lives. Then finally, we will speak with Charles Gallagher, a professor of sociology and chair of the Department of Sociology at La Salle University and author of New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sunbelt. While many are seeing the ostracizing of Donald Sterling for his racist views as a victory over racism, we'll discuss how much deep-seated racial prejudice remains in America. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor of Foreign Policy magazine and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His books include Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, Superclass, The Global Elite and the World They Are Making, and Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. He has an article on foreign policy, The Audacity of Small Ball, Obama's Defense of His Foreign Policy Illustrates Much of What is Wrong with It. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks, David. And the president was obviously quite peeved at the end of his Asian trip in the Philippines. He made this rather, you know, some people have suggested it's almost petulant defense of his foreign policy. What I find extraordinary about it is that, I mean, if he was referring to the constant withering critique from Senators McCain and Lindsey Graham, I could understand why he'd want to pull them over. But the idea that apparently what got under his skin was this pugnacious Fox News reporter, Ed Henry, that got him all worked up. Does Ed Henry deserve this kind of attention?
Ed Henry, I think, was the symptom, right? This is not the only time this has come up, and the entire Ukraine crisis has raised a lot of questions in the minds of a lot of people about the nature of the response of the United States, and was it robust enough and fast enough, and was the Western response robust enough and fast enough? And, I think that was weighing on him, and it weighed on him even more since it came in the wake of problems associated with Syria, when last year we were about to act, and then we didn't act, and then we were going to punt it to Congress, and then there's a chemical deal. But, you know, now that we have the chemical deal, it looks like maybe Assad is going to stay on, you know, and get stronger as a result of the chemical deal, and so that's not working out so well. And I think, you know, the Israel-Palestine talks aren't going very well. I just think he was feeling the heat. And so somebody was going to ask the question sooner or later, and he was going to pop, and that's what happened.
Well, I suppose, I mean, it's a bit surreal, though, to be talking about his foreign policy vis-a-vis Ukraine when, as we speak, we don't know whether Putin's going to invade militarily. And by at this point, where you've got the head of this new government that doesn't have much legitimacy and is hopefully going to have an election on May the 25th, which may or may not happen, this new government in Ukraine has just conceded that they don't have much, if any, authority over the East. And it looks as if Putin has destabilized the East sufficiently that he may be able to just, it'll just fall into his lap. So what's your sense then of what could have been done? Obviously, there was a 1994 agreement with Russia over Crimea that was cynically just ignored. And was that the point where he went wrong?
Well, look, I mean, I think that the response, first of all, of the United States actually predates the crisis, right? Because, you know, leaders are sending messages to themselves all the time, and leaders are assessing each other all the time. And in 2008, in August, Putin went into Georgia, and George Bush initiated some actions against the Russians, including 2 weeks after Putin went into Georgia, Bush sent Condoleezza Rice to Warsaw, and they signed an anti-missile deal. And there were a number of other steps taken, and Obama came in 2009, and because he wanted to reset the relationship with the Russians, he essentially eliminated all the measures that Putin took. So that sent a message. And then, you know, Putin has been backing Assad in Syria and the most kind of brutal behavior. And every time that, you know, the United States said it should stop, the Russians said, you know, get out of our hair. And, you know, the Russians seem to have gotten their way on that. And the United States actually stopped short from taking military action there. So that sent a message. And there have been other instances where similar kind of behavior took place. And so even prior to going into Crimea, Putin had made a calculation that it was extremely unlikely that the United States would lead the West into any kind of response. Now, having said that, you know, after he went into Crimea, you know, there were small responses and big responses possible. You could have initiated bigger, broader sanctions faster. You could have, as the polls said, why don't you relocate a brigade to Poland? You could have done that. The Ukrainian army said, look, send us some, you know, supplies and things that help us, not guns, but blankets and uniforms. You know, we said, well, we'll send you food, you know, MREs, but we're not going to send you even uniforms or blankets. We could have worked much more assiduously with our European allies before we announced that we were going to do sanctions to ensure that they would go along with us. But the first time that we announced sanctions, we hadn't really sort of cleared it with them, and all of a sudden there was pushback, so we looked like we were in disarray. We have the opportunity to say, look, we're going to reinvent the Atlantic Alliance. We have a TTIP conversation about a new kind of a trade deal. That could have been the centerpiece for saying, let's get the NATO leaders together right now. We face new threats. That would have really made the Russians a little bit crazy. And if you'd done all those things, let's get NATO together, let's reassess our threats, let's revitalize the Atlantic Alliance, let's put a brigade in Poland for a year, let's put more ships into the Black Sea sooner. Well, at a certain point, Putin might have become more reticent to take action. And we can't know that, but that's what the speculation is about.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. His latest book is Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, The Audacity of Small Ball, Obama's Defense of His Foreign Policy, illustrates much of what's wrong with it. Now, my sense is, though, that again, talking about whether Ed Henry was the worthy target of Obama's ire in terms of a foreign policy critique, when in fact it would seem to, that it should have been directed at Senator John McCain. And if, when you brought up Georgia, I'm reminded that back during the presidential campaign, when the Georgia situation exploded, in many ways it did because of Randy Scheuermann and McCain's close relationship with this somewhat reckless leader in Georgia, who I think was sucker punched by Putin, wasn't he? I mean, didn't he sort of...
I think he was, but, you know, we also could have learned some things from that, because what happened was Russia went in, and the rest, and they took South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and what happened? The rest of Georgia said, we're turning to the EU, and they embraced the EU associate agreement, and they've moved much closer to the EU, and I think that's likely to be what happens in a effectively divided Ukraine, whether it's, you know, because the eastern provinces, you know, shift off towards Russia, or which is, seems to me perhaps even more likely, the Ukrainians put together a new constitution which allows autonomy and to the various provinces, and the eastern provinces say, okay, we're going to be more independent, more aligned towards Russia. I think at the end of the day, Vladimir Putin is, it's going to be a win-win. He's going to get Crimea. He's going to get influence over these eastern provinces. But that's the short-term outcome. The longer-term outcome, I think, is that the rest of Ukraine, interested in, you know, lunch pail issues, just like anybody else, is going to say, well, there are better jobs and better opportunities in Europe. We're going to tie ourselves closer to Europe. We could have avoided this, by the way, because the Europeans were the ones who went in and said, you know, this is a zero-sum game. Be with us or be with them. And that was foolish, you know. Why should Ukraine have to choose? If they want to have some affiliations with Russia and they want to have some affiliations with Europe, that would be in everybody's interest, and we would have avoided the whole thing.
Well, also, Putin pretty much made it a zero-sum, didn't he, with Yanukovych, and said, you're either with Europe or with us. Was it?
Well, I think that was subsequent to the other.
Right.
I mean, I think that was subsequent to the other, which led to the demonstrations and so forth. But, you know, as far as your other point, sure, Obama's got issues with McCain. But it's not just with McCain, and it's not just about whether we should use military force or we should not use military force. You know, there's a broader critique, which is, does the president of the United States have the wherewithal and the inclination to conduct active U.S. foreign policy worldwide? If so, where is it working? And if not, where is it not working? And there's been, you know, there's been a broad range. Our allies, you know, he was going around Asia, for goodness sakes, during this trip, essentially trying to say to everybody, hey, you know, we're not leaning back. We're reliable. We're still engaged in Asia. We're still going to do our pivot. We're still, going to take your side, Japan, with regard to the Senkaku Islands, or we're going to take your side, Philippines, with regarding other South China Sea disputes with the Chinese. You know, he was essentially there reassuring people who are beginning to lose faith in the United States. The relationships we've got in the Middle East are worse today with virtually every state in the region than they were at the beginning of this administration, even with Iraq, an admitted and acknowledged catastrophe. So it's not just McCain, and it's not just the use of force. It was a broader thing, and that's what got him into a broader analysis. I just found it was kind of extraordinary analysis, because essentially the audacity of Hope Guy, the guy who essentially was handed the Nobel Prize when he arrived in office and started out by saying, I'm going to remake America's relations with the Muslim world and eliminate all nuclear weapons and had lots of big ideas, was essentially saying, nope, we're going to hit singles and doubles. Every once in a while we'll swing for the fences, but this is incremental, and our, you know, key objective is not to make mistakes.
So, in essence, is your critique, David Rothkopf, that he's been a manager as opposed to a leader of foreign policy?
Oh, no, I think he's a terrible manager. I think one of the real problems that Barack Obama has is he doesn't empower the people that works for him. He's got a lot of terrific people that work for him. He doesn't use the totality of the system, the State Department, the Defense Department, the whole economic apparatus in the way that he could. Too much happens in the White House. Too much is controlled by too few people. Too much of the time the deliverable offered by this administration has been a speech from Barack Obama. There hasn't been enough follow-through. He's been too long in making many decisions. We don't want the rashness of George Bush. We don't want the overreach of George Bush. But by the same token, look at the Afghan policy process in the first year of the administration. It took almost a year. At the end of the day, it produced a speech which I call the "Hello, I must be going" speech, because we announced both that we were increasing our troop presence in Afghanistan and that we were leaving in the same speech, which certainly negated in some respects the value of doing either thing. That's bad management. That's running a bad process. Being so White House-centric is bad in terms of management. I think first of all, he didn't have a lot of experience in foreign policy. Secondly, he didn't have a lot of taste for getting personally involved in foreign policy. I don't think he had a particularly well-developed foreign policy vision. And, you know, to some extent, that's understandable given his background. And essentially, he was elected to get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan, and fix the financial crisis. And, you know, he's certainly trying to follow through on those things. You know, the world really needs a certain kind of leadership from the United States, because the institutions that we have were established in the wake of the Second World War. They're antiquated. A new set of issues are emerging associated with cyber and big data world. We don't have the mechanisms or the philosophies to deal with them. We may want to lean back. We need new alliances to help do burden sharing. We're not doing what we need to do to advance our interests worldwide, and I think that's why there's a critique.
So, David Rothkopf, in terms of Putin eating Obama's lunch, I mean, obviously, you know, even if you go back to Georgia, had Georgia been in NATO back then, it's difficult to know whether we would have gone to war against Russia over that, or conversely, whether Russia would have been deterred because of that. But clearly, in this case, Russia is not deterred in any sense, and they're winning. But is this a case of the president and his team not watching closely enough? I mean, first of all, it seems like they were surprised by the invasion itself, which certainly I thought was going to happen. And I talked to people in Moscow, like Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who said it was going to happen. And then you have the issue that you brought up about the EU, you know, taunting the wounded bear by forcing the Ukrainian government into a us or them situation, which, again, did that happen because our side wasn't watching the ball? I mean, what's going on here?
Well, first of all, there have been some interesting stories about how much the Russians were able to do below the radar because of any benefits they may have accrued from Snowden revelations, which is an interesting side story. Secondly, I think the United States was aware that some things were happening, but we, frankly, I don't think had a well-developed plan for responding to them. And so essentially we waited and we waited to take action. There were also divisions and remain divisions within the United States government about how quickly to act. There are a lot of economic interests in the United States that feel that, you know, too many sanctions or too broad an impact on Russia would be devastating economically. Big oil has some interest there. Obviously, the Europeans have some interest there as well. And so, you know, you had some people, for example, in the State Department saying do more, some people in the Defense Department saying do more, and at the same time, some people saying go slow, so there wasn't a lot of agreement on this. And I don't think we sort of calculated very carefully what our effective levers were with regard to the Russians, because we do have some effective levers. The reality is, I think, to a large extent, we needed the Russians to help us in Syria. We need the Russians to help us in Iran. We didn't want to blow up the relationship because those were foreign policy priorities of the president. And so it was a combination of unpreparedness, divisions within the administration, needing them for other things, and a lack of particularly good options that led to essentially a kind of flaccid response.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. His latest book is Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, The Audacity of Small Ball, Obama's Defense of His Foreign Policy, illustrates much of what's wrong with it. But how much is this to do with the who we're dealing with in terms of Putin? I mean, you know, apparently when Bush looked into his eyes and saw his soul, later on Bush said, you know, the guy's a gangster. I mean, clearly he is, and we're dealing with something somewhat different in terms of what diplomacy is normally about. And my sense is that since we can't do anything,
what's likely to happen here is that Putin is likely to swallow too much and have geopolitical indigestion. Even Crimea is going to turn out to be expensive. Ukraine's going to turn out to be a massive mess. And it's not as if there's a lot we could do. And he may end up, you know, being hoisted on his own petard, Putin.
Well, look, first of all, I think you're obviously right. And it's very important to make the point, because we're doing this, having this conversation in the context of remarks from the president, that the bad actor in Ukraine and Crimea is Putin. And to some extent, Yanukovych, and to some extent, a bunch of other corrupt politicians in Ukraine. And that the president was reacting to all of this. Secondly, there was a guy, a kind of military analyst that I knew many years ago, who used to say the dirtiest fighter sets the rules of the contest. You know, if he is willing to go and take land, if he is willing to break laws, if he is willing to do whatever it takes, he's gonna win. We have found that time and again. And you know, there's no better example of that than Assad, who is literally a human weapon of mass destruction. And even as we get rid of some chemical weapons, we're seeing him use ones that aren't on the list and kill tens of thousands of people and blow up his own country in order to stay alive. And because we haven't been willing to challenge him, he's going to. He's going to win. You know, he's going to be in power for a long, long time, even if there's a civil war going on there for a long time. And so, one of the things we have to come to grips with is either we can mobilize our allies, take action, take risks, stand up to these people. Doesn't mean we have to invade. Doesn't mean we have to put boots on the ground. It may mean we have to sustain some economic blows because we're really sanctioning people in a meaningful way. It may mean that we have to work much harder diplomatically to renew and restore our alliances so that we can put collective pressure on people. But until we do something that really hurts, until it's really in the interest for Putin not to take these steps, he's going to keep taking them. And I think one of the messages of Ukraine is we've seen it happen in Georgia. We're seeing him not be content with Crimea. He essentially has GRU, espionage units, and Spetsnaz, special forces units, in Ukraine, just, plainclothes. Or without insignia on their military clothes, going in and doing what they want and essentially, invading the country without invading the country, non-invasion invasion. And we are sitting there for that. And if he sees that that works out his way, well, if I were in Moldova or I were in Estonia, I'd be pretty darned uncomfortable. And I think because of that, we do need to think about whether different kinds of NATO deployments are needed, different kinds of missile defense strategies are needed, broader economic sanctions are needed, whether we are really willing to bear the political costs of isolating the Russians more. Because unless they discover that we're serious and they're going to pay a price, there is every reason to believe that this will continue.
Just in closing, I have to mention, David Rothkopf, that just today, on Wednesday, the NBC Wall Street Journal poll was released saying that nearly half of Americans say the U.S. should be less active in foreign affairs. So,
well, I think it's more. I think it's more than that. There are 30% or so that say that we're they like the level we're at, which is fairly inactive, and 47% say we should be less active. So that's three quarters of Americans that say we should be at where we are or less. Mm-hmm. And so, Barack Obama is the president that this America wants, and this kind of involvement is the involvement that they want. But if you look at the same poll, the data with regard to Ukraine shows broad unhappiness with the outcome. And this is the discontinuity that presidents have to deal with. The people don't want Americans to be put at risk. They don't want to spend money on international issues, but they want things to work out. And sometimes choices have got to be made. And the president's trying to have it both ways, and it's not working out. I think you can go and look around the world, and we're not safer today. There's you know, whether it's the Middle East, where there's more al-Qaeda today than there were at any time, where there's more countries unstable than there have been at any time in the recent past, where Iraq is coming apart, where Afghanistan's likely to come apart, where the Arab awakening looks like it's producing strongman regimes in Egypt and chaos in Libya and, you know, more Assad in Syria, or whether it's Putin on the move in his own near abroad, we have some issues to deal with. And this would be a great opportunity for the president to step up and work with allies to find reasonable ways to share the burden of stabilizing these situations and putting international law back in effect. And right now, he's not showing the will to do that. And I think, you know, there's time. He could do better. George Bush did better in the last 2 years he had in office than he did in the first six by a long shot. And I think Barack Obama could do the same.
Well, David Rothkopf, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And his latest book is Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. He has an article at Foreign Policy, The Audacity of Small Ball. Obama's defense of his foreign policy illustrates much of what's wrong with it. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into why 1 in 20 sentenced to death in America are likely innocent.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sam Gross, who's a professor of law at the University of Michigan, where he teaches evidence, criminal procedure, and courses on wrongful criminal convictions. He is the editor of the National Registry of Exonerations and the lead author of a new study that finds more than 4% of inmates sentenced to death in the United States are likely innocent. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Gross.
Good to be here.
And this study that you have were the lead author on is under the – it's been published by the American Academy of Sciences, is it not? It's called Rate of False Conviction of Criminal Defenders Who Are Sentenced to Death.
That's correct. It's published by, in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
So when you say likely innocent, that's not a very precise term, is it?
It's a precise term in the context in which we're using it. What we have done is we've estimated the rate of innocence for people who were sentenced to death in the United States since 1973, in the same way that you estimate the rate of death for people who are alive now but will die over time of heart disease or of cancer or something like that. We don't know who they are. And we don't know with precision what the number will be, but we have a good estimate that is far closer and far more precise than any estimate of the false conviction rate in any other context.
Well, of course, we're talking about this in the context of this botched execution in Oklahoma that was just so grim and grisly and despicable and disgraceful that it's bound to bring up a lot of opposition that's been, I think, on the rise in terms of the death penalty. But there's nothing more profound, I think, as an indictment of the United States, along with some of the more reactionary countries in the world, like China and Iran and Saudi Arabia being the chief executioners on the planet. Nothing is more of an indictment than putting to death innocent men and women What's your understanding of, given that you looked into the outcomes of 7,482 death sentences handed down between 1973 and 2004, and of that group, 117, or 1.6%, were exonerated? You've obviously gone beyond that. Mm-hmm. So what's the number of, do you think, of innocent people that have been put to death in that time frame, 73 to 2004?
We don't know that, and we don't try to estimate that. What we can say is that considering the rate of conviction of innocent people and at trials in which they're sentenced to death, it's all but certain that at least several of the people who've been executed in the United States have been innocent, and possibly more. We do go to great lengths to try to avoid executing innocent people. That's why so many people who are sentenced to death are exonerated. But we're not that good, and we certainly miss many of the cases. But there's a second tragedy behind that people don't think of as much, and that is not quite as grisly, but equally disturbing. And that's the people who are sentenced to death and then have their sentence reduced from the death penalty to life in prison. In many cases, because judges or prosecutors or governors are concerned that they might be innocent. And then after that, we largely forget about them. In effect, we say, this person might be innocent. Oh my God, we must not execute him. But then we don't do very much to determine whether they're innocent or guilty. We don't pay much attention to the case again, and the effect is that they'll stay in prison until they die anyway. And that happens more often to people who were sentenced to death who are innocent than executions by a lot. That's the largest group of people who are innocent who are sentenced to death are not exonerated and not executed. They're resentenced to life imprisonment and then forgotten, and they die in prison.
So it's like, you know, they breathe a sigh of relief that they're not going to be executed, but then they spend the rest of their lives rotting in jail, and they may just be simply innocent.
That's right.
And so that they lose the attention and then rot in jail. So
that's right. In an ironic way, the death sentence that everybody fears so much, for the same reason that it's so terrible and so scary, increases the attention that a defendant will get. And if he's innocent, greatly increases the chances that his innocence will be discovered and that he'll be freed. If you're then just another person who's been sentenced to life imprisonment, in most cases, nobody pays attention.
Again, I'm speaking with Sam Gross, who's professor of law at the University of Michigan, where he teaches evidence, criminal procedure, and courses on wrongful criminal convictions. He's the editor of the National Registry of Exonerations and is the lead author of a new study that finds more than 4% of inmates sentenced to death in the United States are likely innocent. So in your research then, Sam Gross, is there any coherent explanation for why the American judicial system is so imprecise, that so many people get not just sentenced to death, but as you pointed out, those that dodge the bullet in terms of being executed are still innocent, yet they rot away for their life with a life sentence? Why is our judicial system, particularly when it comes to capital cases like this, so imprecise?
We know of various things that contribute to the errors that we've discovered. Mistakes by eyewitnesses, confessions by people who are innocent who've been essentially, you know, coerced or deceived into saying confessing falsely, lies by other witnesses who testify against them, in some cases the real criminals who shift the blame to somebody else. Misuse or failure to make good use of forensic evidence and other physical evidence, misconduct by prosecutors and police officers, frequently in the most serious type that we know about is concealing evidence of innocence, misconduct by defense attorneys who don't do the job they're supposed to, don't interview witnesses or put on a good defense, and are not there to catch errors when they should be able to do that. I can't say there's any single cause. And I also don't think we know that the American system is worse than other systems in making these mistakes. It might be, but we don't have equally good information on convictions in European countries or Asian countries or any place else in the world, really. What stands out about America by comparison to other Western countries is that we're much more punitive. When we do make mistakes, they're worse because we sentence people to prison for very long periods of time, and we're the only Western country that continues to employ the death penalty. And in this case, we are able to show that we make a substantial number of mistakes among people who are sentenced to death.
And we also have more people in jail, do we not, per capita than any other country in the world?
Correct. And more than we've ever had, and more than anybody else has now or ever has had.
And a preponderance of those, or a disproportionate number of those, are African-American and other minorities.
That's right. A majority of them are African-American or other minorities.
And the two that were up for execution in Oklahoma, the one whose execution was botched and died horribly, he was African-American. That's not to say that he was in any way innocent. I don't know the facts surrounding his case. But is that a factor? Is that minorities just don't, they can't afford lawyers? You know, there may be...
It's a possibility. It doesn't jump out as an issue in terms of convictions of innocent people in capital cases, except as part of the basic background fact that you already mentioned, which is that minorities and African Americans in particular are heavily disproportionately represented in the prison population. And by the same token, they are overrepresented on death row and overrepresented among those who are exonerated because they were sent to death row in error. But not, I think, any more than for other crimes. And in some crimes, in particular drug crimes, African Americans are even more radically overrepresented than they are among murder cases.
Again, I'm speaking with Sam Gross, who's professor of law at the University of Michigan, where he teaches evidence, criminal procedure, and courses on wrongful criminal convictions. He's the editor of the National Registry of Exonerations and is the lead author of a new study that finds more than 4% of inmates sentenced to death in the United States are likely innocent. So in terms of the study that you've just done, that published by the National Academy of Sciences, Sam Gross, do you think that concurrent with the outrage over this botched execution in Oklahoma, that there will be a sort of momentum gathering to end death penalty in this country? As you point out, we're the only Western country that has the death penalty. And the former Supreme Court justice who retired has gone public about, you know, how it should never have come back. It almost went away altogether.
Our use of the death penalty, the legal status of the death penalty in the United States is very complex, and it's gone through quite a few changes in my lifetime. Several retired Supreme Court justices have expressed opposition to the death penalty. Probably the one who was most startling was Lewis Powell, who did that about, oh, God, it must be 15 years ago or more, maybe 20 years ago. And there is more opposition to the death penalty and less support for it now than there was 10 or 15, certainly 20 years ago. Will this report continue that trend? That's a possibility. When people are asked about their views about the death penalty, those who oppose it frequently talk about the danger of executing innocent people. And those who change their mind, when they're asked why they change their mind, often mention that. So it might make a difference. I think it's important to remember that the problem that we're talking about here is much more general than the death penalty, and that the number of innocent people who are sentenced to prison for other crimes is far, far greater than the number of innocent people who are sentenced to die. However terrible that consequence is, it's in terms of the numbers, a small fraction of the number of innocent people who are sentenced to prison in the United States.
So even if there is some movement towards getting rid of the death penalty and it's gaining some momentum, your other comment that we're the most punitive society in the world, is that just in our DNA? That's not likely to go away?
I hope it's not in our DNA. It hasn't always been true in the United States. The huge increase in punitiveness and buildup in the prison population didn't start until the late 1970s. It peaked just several years ago. The prison population has declined a little bit, but not very much in the last several years. But it's a phenomenon that occurred within my lifetime, within my adult lifetime. And I would like to think it could be reversed, if not within my lifetime, perhaps within the lifetime of my children.
Well, Sam Gross, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Sam Gross. He's a professor of law at the University of Michigan, where he teaches evidence, criminal procedure, and courses on wrongful criminal conviction. He's the editor of the National Registry of Exonerations and the lead author of the new study that finds more than 4% of inmates sentenced to death in the United States are likely innocent. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how much deep-seated racial prejudice remains in America after the downfall of Donald Sterling.
Yeah. I see my light cook shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, I shall be released.
Because a few of them were white, and it's the same across the nation. Black and white discrimination. Yeah, and you can't understand me, and all that other jazz they hand me in the papers and TV, and all that mass stupidity that seems to grow more every day. Each time you hear something it would say, he wants to go and do you in. Cause the color of your skin just don't appeal to him, no matter if it's black or white, because he's out for blood tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Charles Gallagher, who's a professor of sociology and the chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at La Salle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two new books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sunbelt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Gallagher.
Pleasure to be here.
And there's obviously a lot of, I don't want to be too cynical in terms of the country congratulating itself about how a terrible racist has had this public downfall. But so much of what happened to Donald Sterling was in effect at the rhetorical level, since it came from a surreptitiously recorded conversation with his mistress, and it expressed his personal views. But isn't there a gulf between the rhetoric of racism and the reality of racism?
Well, I think that's exactly it. And I think what happened with Sterling is that the curtain was pulled back on people that know the drill. Most people in positions of power understand that you cannot engage in racist language, anything that's perceived to be socially inappropriate, in public. You can do it in private. You can do it when you're around people that are like-minded with your own people. You can do it with your mistress if you believe you're not being tape recorded. But what I think is interesting is that what was picked up is a conversation that happens hundreds of thousands of times in people's living rooms and people's workrooms when they're around people that are the same race as themselves. So I'm not shocked by this. It's just that he got caught saying it.
So how deep-seated, then, is racial prejudice in America?
Well, you know what I think, Ian, is that, you know, and I'm in the middle of a new project now where I'm interviewing a number of whites across the age spectrum in four different neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And, you know, once the tape recorder gets running, people let down. They let down their guard. And, you know, if I had to characterize the United States simply, I'd say that there are three Americas. And the first population, which I think is relatively small, are people that kind of get it. They understand the historical legacy of race and racism. They understand institutional racism. And they understand that cities look the way they do, schools are structured and resources the way they are, because of our 300 years of institutional racism. And so they people get it. And I think the next category are people that have learned to be tolerant, at least ostensibly, but they broker in stereotypes, stereotypes of blacks or Mexicans or Asians. And they know the drill also, because at work they know that they're not allowed to engage in certain behaviors because it breaks the law. But in their own private spaces, these folks basically will go right to the stereotypes, right to the kind of like the kinds of ugly things we say about other groups. And then I think the third group are people like Sterling. I think that, like, the guy Bundy, Cliveden. And I think that these folks are just old-school racists in many ways. And I think if you look at the second and third group, that's the majority of the United States. And I think we congratulate ourselves on the back. We tried out this notion of colorblindness because we have a black president, yet every quality of life indicator points that race still matters enormously in the United States.
So how much, then, is this an historical fact that there's always been this kind of ghettoization in the United States? And, you know, we have here in Los Angeles, where, of course, Sterling lives in Beverly Hills, but he grew up on the east side, which is the poorer and multiracial part of town. And, you know, most of the African-Americans and Latinos live in the east and the whites live in the west. And then if you go back through our history in New York, you know, the Irish had their ghetto, the Jews had their ghettos. But the difference was, it seems, in earlier parts of our history, you know, notwithstanding the Civil War and of course, the hideous of slavery, there seems to have been more social mobility. So is this really an issue of social mobility?
Well, I think what's happening is that I think you're right in that there's an element of social mobility. And what's happened is that for much of the middle class, the rug has been pulled out. So where whites could, many whites, in Philadelphia is a good example, you could drop out of high school in the 1970s and walk into a factory or a mill and get a job that paid a living wage where you could buy a row house. Those days are over. So I think a lot of whites that are at economic margins are scrambling as well. And of course, everyone, the way it works is the kind of like pecking order, the queue is such that if you're a racial minority, you're always going to be below, you're going to be lowest in the queue. So I think that we are segregating by, if you look at quintiles of income, we are segregating by income. And income and race are very highly correlated. And so these things are happening, but at the same time, what you have happening is resegregation of our cities. Our schools are more segregated than they were in the 1960s in many American cities. And what that really is about is that whites basically continuing not to want to live even in the smallest percent of neighborhoods where there's a non-white population. So for most whites, once you get to 10% black, the tipping point has happened. There's a psychological tipping point, and most whites will not buy a house in that neighborhood, and the whites that live there will start to think about moving out. And then once they move out, it's classic white flight. So income plays out, but again, race becomes, race is in some kind of secondary feature of class. It plays in and of itself as a variable.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Gallagher, who's a professor of sociology and the chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at LaSalle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two new books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sun Belt. So given these facts, though, you know, we're also told, Charles, that the millennials, the younger generation between 20 and 30, are post-racial and post-sexual in terms of their hang-ups over homosexuality. So how do you factor that in at the same time as we discuss there's less social mobility? So I'm wondering how much we're in denial about a bigger issue, and that is class. And I think to some extent Sterling was one of those billionaires whose arrogance was so obvious was because he had so much money. I mean, he had a plantation mentality. It's true he had an antediluvian racial view of African Americans, but at the same time he had this patronizing, you know, I'm the job creator kind of mentality.
Right.
You know
what
I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, he's a unique character. I mean, this man has a history of engaging in racist behavior, and he was brought to the courts about this, about what he was doing with his tenants. So he doesn't like Mexicans, he doesn't like blacks, and he acted that way. So not only is he prejudiced, but he's an actual discriminator. So, I mean, this man, and I think we shouldn't, you know, lose sight of the fact that if he's forced to sell his team, he's going to go from selling, you know, buying something for $12 million and selling it for possibly $1 billion. So I think it's ironic how basically people at the top can basically maintain their privilege. But I mean, back to your original point about the younger generation, they are more tolerant if you believe in survey data. And, you know, the bottom line is that more people are not upset about someone black and white or white and brown marrying. You know, people say live and let live. You know, but again, the numbers are very small. You know, we're talking about like 6% of the population. But that said, what has happened, and I think how the colorblind narrative plays out, people don't say that blacks are such and such because of biological reasons, that the kind of old Jim Crow racism that was grounded in, you know, first the Bible and then science, that's been thrown out. What's replaced it is culture. And that's a narrative that people can say, well, I have black friends and they're like me, we're both in college, they're okay. But when I drive through North Philadelphia or a barrio, those folks have problems. They're the architects of their own demise because of the culture that they basically have passed on to their children. So it becomes a culture of poverty argument has emerged again among these kids. And they're able to discern good blacks from bad blacks. And all this does is kind of reify and recreate another version of us and them. So you're right. I mean, if you're an upper middle class kid, and you're in a white suburban high school and you have a black friend next to you, the likelihood is that kid's going to come from a background that's similar to yours and you'll have a lot in common. Driving through the city is a different deal. And again, once you do that, you can start saying, what's wrong with this kid? Why do they live this way without any understanding of American history? And I think that's the danger.
But in terms of us being a class society, and we have the 1%, and we have the 1% of the 1% who have an inordinate wealth. Just one family, the Waltons, have the wealth equivalent to 40% of the lower end of American families, which is an extraordinary statistic. So, you know, it seems to me that when we talk about race, we forget that there are more white people in poverty, more white people on welfare, and more white people on food stamps.
Right. There are more poor white people than any other group in the United States. The big difference is that white poverty is diffuse. It's dispersed. It's in the city. It's in the suburb. And it's in rural places. Black and brown poverty is overwhelmingly concentrated in very, very tight parts of urban areas. So it's very visible. It becomes visible in the news. So, of course, this cements another stereotype about people on welfare, people that are poor, and that being associated with brown and black. And you have to, so it's also interesting, if you look at black family households that make $75,000, they are more segregated. So imagine, we're talking about $75,000. That's way over the median family income. Blacks at that income level are more segregated than poor whites. So even blacks that are doing well tend to live in all black neighborhoods where they typically have less social services. The schools aren't as good. So even when you control for class, and I would argue, you know, the United States, we always say there is no class here. We're not like the UK, right? We threw off those shackles. We don't talk about class in the United States, because if you talk about class in the United States, what you're also talking about is a system that's rigged. You know, Ian, I always tell my students, they don't understand it at first, I always say to them, pick your parents well. You know, of course, they don't understand. And then they realize, you know, what does it mean to come from an upper middle class neighborhood where your parents have enormous amounts of resources to invest in you? So class and race are tied together in the United States, but all of it gets washed over by this bootstrapping notion that anybody can make it in the United States, and case in point is Barack Obama.
Just in closing, though, it would seem to me, and a lot of people I've had on my program have made this argument, that in many ways it's the Republicans who are keeping racism alive because it's the glue that keeps white men in particular voting for them because of their fear of this demographic change that's underway.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that a lot of people are cheering recent decisions of the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court is full of us that believe we've turned the corner on race. I think it's interesting, the Voting Rights Act, there was discussion, this is no longer needed because municipalities don't discriminate anymore. The whole discussion about affirmative action is a perfect example of basically pandering to a very, very small base. I'm sure you've talked about affirmative action, what's going on with the court case in Michigan. Here you have a system where they include where you're from, the region you're from, the state you're from, if you're from a family of poverty, if you're international, if you play a music instrument, if you're gifted, if you've done community service, they privilege people if they're male or female. They privilege people if they're on a sports team. They absolutely privilege legacies. It's the most powerful helping hand to get into an elite school. Of all these variables, everybody freaks out about race. You have to think to yourself, why is it all these other things that people do to have a diverse student body, why is it one variable makes white American males in particular, apoplectic? And I think what you do is you throw these bones, these dog whistles get sounded, and they become something that pulls the troops together. And I think you're absolutely right. The problem is they're running out of things to feed this. White males make up about 35% of the population. And in many ways, if you look at Fortune 100 companies, and you look at vice president above, 95-94% of those people are white males, yet they only constitute 35% of the population. And these folks at the top, they don't care about these issues. These issues are basically put out there for white males that are failing economically, that'll never live the life of their grandparents or never have the mobility of their fathers. And I think this is the way you keep the troops together. You give them these cultural little pieces of, I guess they're crumbs, right, to keep them basically in the party.
Well, Charles Gallagher, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome. Nice talking to you again.
Good talking to you again, Charles. Again, I've been speaking with Charles Gallagher. He's a professor of sociology and chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at LaSalle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two new books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sunbelt. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Who will ever know how much she loves?